the birth anniversary of a highly revered woman in Islam, Lady Fatima. Also known as Zahra, Hazrat Fatima was the daughter of Prophet Muhammad and the wife of Imam Ali, the first Shia Imam. Here, in the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam in the city of Mashhad, Muslims from Iran and other countries gathered to celebrate the festive occasion.
I congratulate all Muslims on the birthday anniversary of Hazrat Fatima. Lady Fatima is an example of piety, compassion, and generosity. The Prophet Muhammad regarded her as the best of women. He kissed her hand in public to show the high status of women at a time when female children were seen as a disgrace.
Still, after 14 centuries, Muslims speak highly of Hazrat Fatima. Muslim women view her as a role model.
Hazrat Fatima made great contributions to the promotion of Islamic teachings. Fatima is extolled and praised in the Book of Quran in a surah called Kawthar, which tells Prophet Muhammad that God has given you Fatima as a gift.
Iranians' love for the daughter of Prophet Muhammad goes beyond these celebrations. Many families name their daughters after her, and that's why Fatima and Zahra are the most common names among Iranian women, including this lady who has asked her fiancé to start their marriage on the birthday of Lady Fatima.
My name is Zahra. My parents named me after Lady Zahra, and I'm so grateful for that. She is an inspirational figure. That's why my husband and I decided to start our marriage on the auspicious occasion of her birthday.
Lady Fatima's name went down in history as an alpha female who continues to inspire Muslim women to date. Iranians here say they celebrate Women's Day on Hazrat Fatima's birthday to shed light on the inner beauty of women and their pivotal role in building a better family and better society. Mashhad.
Sana is dying. She was born just a few days ago. But because of a rare birth malformation, doctors believe she only has a few days to live. Sana is one of the thousands of Yemeni babies facing a similar fate. Here in the Sab'een Hospital in the Yemeni capital, doctors say they have been receiving birth defect cases at an alarming rate since 2015. That's when the Saudi-led coalition launched its war on Yemen. Doctors here are convinced that biological weapons were employed by the Saudis.
We've received many birth defect cases throughout the years. However, this is the first time we received a case like this. She does not have the bottom limbs or kidneys or even a urinary tract or liver. She is missing all of her bottom half organs. Malformation cases have risen significantly since 2015. We believe the rise in these cases is due to the hazardous poisons from the weapons being used in the war.
Cancer cases are also on the rise. The spokesperson for Yemen's Ministry of Health says that the data and statistics recorded since the war started indicate that biological weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition are the main cause of the steady increase in cancer and birth defects.
These cases are rising in the areas that were targeted by illegal weapons in a number of provinces in Yemen, which has led to a significant increase of various kinds of cancer cases and also birth defects and miscarriages. It was never like this prior to the war.
We visited the registration office at Yemen's only oncology center. It was packed with people pushing their way to register for cancer treatment.
I am here to register for medication. I have oral cancer.
I have just received another case. The person who just registered is from Eb and has liver cancer.
According to Yemen's Ministry of Health, the number of cancer patients increased by more than 50% since the war was launched in 2015. The Yemeni Ministry of Health says it will form a committee to officially investigate the main cause for the increase in birth defects and cancer cases in the areas that have been hit the most by the Saudi airstrikes. Even if it's evident that prohibited weapons were utilized by Saudi Arabia and its coalition forces, It is unlikely they will face prosecution, since most of the weapons used in the war are supplied by the American and British governments.
Doctors and medical experts say the increase in cancer and birth defect cases is rooted in the 8-year Saudi-led war that has polluted Yemen's air, water, and food. They blame the Saudi-led coalition's use of prohibited weapons such as biological weapons, toxic gases, and cluster bombs. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol told journalists this week he wants to be more involved with the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons to defend his country from North Korea.
We have not seen any results yet, but South Korea and the U.S. will cooperate in the system, which the U.S. has been operating unilaterally. Although nuclear assets are U.S. assets, South Korea will participate in their operation, and the two countries will work together to respond to the threat of North Korea's nuclear escalation.
President Yoon has resumed large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea war games and strengthened Seoul's alliance with Washington. However, U.S. President Joe Biden has so far stopped short of coordinating the deployment of nuclear weapons. The U.S. has conducted several missions to South Korea involving so-called strategic assets, weapons that can deliver nuclear bombs. Amid the South Korea-U.S. military buildup, civil society leaders meeting in Seoul this week called on President Yoon to make greater efforts to pursue dialogue with North Korea. Under the previous progressive president, Moon Jae-in, engagement with North Korea reduced tensions, which have only flared up again with the election of President Yoon and renewed North Korean missile tests in 2022. South Korean peace activists say 2023, the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War armistice, marks an occasion to increase their campaign to officially end the war. Meanwhile, President Yoon plans to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the South Korea-U.S. alliance with record-level military exercises. Frank Smith, Seoul.
They took months to be held, but only hours to fail. Negotiations between unions and the UK government aimed at working out mainly pay deals to prevent another wave of public sector disruptions.
We are talking about people who are working well beyond their contracted hours anyway, just to get the job done, because they can't hand patients over and because they care so much. So for the government to be talking about productivity in exchange for a pay award is an insult to every single one of our members.
An insult to his union members and perhaps to other public sector workers across the country, protesting against the government's refusal to give them pay rises that keep pace with inflation, which soared above 10% in October last year. The same month, public sector pay in real terms hit a 19-year low.
Brexit has destroyed investment. It's led to us being a less attractive place for foreign direct investment as well. So, unfortunately, we've got a lot of self-inflicted wounds, plus Ukraine, plus, you know, fairly incompetent government.
But the government is digging in. Instead of making concessions, it has introduced controversial new legislation to Parliament designed to curb the impact of the strikes. Critics of the new bill are warning of the consequences.
Once you start sacking people, people are more likely to even go on strike together. I mean, ultimately, this is so much against the trade union movement, they risk a national strike over it, because trade unions will gang together to make sure that they have an impact and stop this kind of legislation.
Without the desired pay offers from the government, those walkouts are bound to go ahead, with tens of thousands of transport workers, National Health Service staff, civil servants and others set to take part in industrial action this month and beyond.
There are more strikes in the UK today than in more than a decade, driven by a cost of living crisis and a lack of inflation-matching pay rises. The unions are saying enough is enough, and that the only way for them to cease further industrial action is hard, cold cash. It remains to be seen if the UK government will be the first one to blink in this staring contest. Saeed Purizep, London.
Families of prisoners and their advocates have staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails and detention centers. Tel Aviv practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, and Al-Quds. Among those apartheid policies is the bad treatment of Palestinian prisoners.
The prisoners are suffering tremendously inside Zionist jails, and we pray for their release. My son was only 17 when he was arrested and has been behind bars since 1992. He's a freedom fighter who fought for the liberation of Al-Quds and Palestine.
Palestinian prisoners who are held in 24 Israeli jails and detention centers are all denied basic human rights.
Prisoners' advocacy groups are calling on the international community to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its grave violations against Palestinian prisoners.
Meanwhile, a workshop was held in the blockaded territory on how to tackle the dangers posed by right-wing Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir on Palestinian prisoners. The workshop was organized by Hamas's Wa'id Prisoners Society and the Islamic Jihad's Mujahid al-Quds Foundation for Prisoners. Attendees discussed ways of confronting threats by the extremist Israeli minister.
It's our duty to protect and fight for Palestinian prisoners amid the ongoing attempts by Ben-Gvir and the Zionist entity to pass a law that allows the execution of Palestinian prisoners as well as the deportation of Palestinian prisoners. We are facing a big Zionist project targeting not only the prisoners but also all aspects of Palestinian existence.
For decades, the Israeli regime has violated all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention.
The issue of Palestinian prisoners is at the core of the Palestinian cause. They are held in Zionist jails because they fought for the freedom of Palestine and have kept the Palestinian cause alive. Palestinian prisoners have played a major role in fighting the Zionist project that aims to empty Palestine of its indigenous Palestinian population.
Palestinians are calling on the international community to break their silence and help Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
We will not be beaten. This is the title of a newly released documentary produced by Press TV. The documentary has been made based on 5,000 minutes of footage and documents collected and released by the U.S. media regarding domestic violence against women and the violation of women's rights in the United States. We Will Not Be Beaten tells the documented story of the high rate of domestic violence and physical abuse against women in the U.S.
This documentary, ordered by Press TV, has been made based on 5,000 minutes of footage and documents regarding violation of women's rights and violence against women, which have been collected and released by the U.S. media. Also, in order to have a better understanding of the situation in the United States, we have interviewed many people who have been living in the U.S. for 10 to 20 years.
According to official statistics, there are more than 20,000 phone calls placed to domestic violence hotlines in the U.S. every day. Moreover, one in every three women in the U.S. experience rape and physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime.
This documentary has shown the realities regarding violation of women's rights and domestic violence against women in the United States. It shows that the only thing that the U.S. does not care about is the rights of women. One example is the U.S. proposed resolution which led to the ouster of Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women. The production of such documentaries will further shed light on the double standards policies of Washington with regard to women's rights.
While Western media outlets have launched a propaganda against Iran with regard to the status of women, we have released a new documentary titled We Will Not Be Beaten to depict the true status of women in the U.S. As Press TV has been the voice of the voiceless, we have made our efforts to be the voice of the rising number of American women who are facing domestic violence and physical abuse on a daily basis.
Domestic violence against women has seen an alarming uptick in recent years in the United States, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. A report by the Council on Criminal Justice found that reports of domestic violence in the U.S. have jumped by over 8% during the pandemic lockdown.
Esper's TV documentary has shown the high rate of violence against women in the U.S. has been recognized as a public health concern, with media in the U.S. contributing to making domestic violence appear unimportant to the public. Experts say given such realities on the ground, the U.S. cannot serve as a role model for women's rights in the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
United States President Joe Biden has visited the Mexican border for just the first time in his presidency. An estimated 8,000 asylum seekers cross the Texas border every day, with last year breaking records. Official data showed that the number of undocumented immigrant crossings at the southwest border reached 2.8 million people, breaking the annual record by more than 1 million. In yet another major expansion of a policy of Donald Trump, which the Democratic Party criticized for years, Biden announced the U.S. will immediately deport even more new arrivals. Biden has also drastically increased the number of deportations from the Trump era. The United States accepts fewer refugees per capita than almost any other Western nation, and the world's wealthiest country refuses to provide adequate resettlement and border services.
Let's not forget that the Biden administration still is running the very same for-profit internment camps on the southern border that are full of immigrants. When Trump was president, there was rightfully a lot of criticism of these policies. These are not just holding cells or whatever. These are basically internment camps where large numbers of immigrants, including families and children, are held.
Rarely discussed in the mainstream media is that U.S. foreign policy has played a major role in the Western Hemisphere's long-running refugee crisis. Instead, both the media and Biden's immigration policy give special priority to asylum seekers leaving socialist-inspired nations, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua.
Encouraging them to leave these countries that have socialist governments. And then, of course, the U.S. government says, look at these people fleeing so-called communism. It's exactly what the Biden administration's spokespeople have been saying. It's basically, right-wing Cold War-style propaganda. And the reality is that these people are not fleeing. These people are going to the United States because the U.S. is telling them, we're going to give you visas.
2022 saw seemingly the entire West accused of racism due to their privileging of refugees from Ukraine over non-white asylum seekers. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
A new report has revealed that the U.S. lied about Afghan civilians killed in 2021 drone strike. Reports say U.S. officials knew the strike killed 10 family members, including 7 children. They covered it up for over a year. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, erroneous assumptions and biases by U.S. analysts led to the Kabul drone attack that killed 10 civilians, including 7 children, during the Pentagon's chaotic August 2021 withdrawal from Afghanistan. An internal military investigation has reportedly found. Tensions were running high on the day of the drone strike, just 3 days after the August 26 terrorist bombing that killed 13 U.S. troops and more than 100 Afghans at the Kabul airport. The probe by U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, noted that another attack by ISIS was expected that day and that intelligence reports indicated it would involve a white Toyota Corolla, the New York Times reported recently. Military analysts observed a white Corolla stopping at what they believed was an ISIS compound, so they began tracking the car, the report said. After the vehicle pulled into a gated courtyard near the airport hours later, a Hellfire missile strike on the car by an MQ-9 Reaper drone was ordered. Later that day, U.S. officials announced that they had successfully prevented another terrorist bombing. As reports of civilian deaths began to surface, U.S. officials said they had no indications of such casualties and were investigating whether a secondary explosion might have killed someone. However, the Times said CENTCOM's investigation revealed that analysts reported within 20 minutes of the strike that civilians may have been killed. Within 3 hours, they had assessed that at least 3 children were killed. Military officials continued to conceal what they knew about the strike. 3 days later, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley said the attack was righteous and that it had killed an ISIS facilitator and unknown others. The driver of the Corolla turned out to be an aid worker who had spent the day picking up his employer's laptop, taking colleagues to and from work, and loading canisters of water into his trunk to bring home to his family. The CENTCOM investigation was completed a week and a half after the drone strike and was never released to the public, the Times said. 16 months later, the newspaper obtained 66 partially redacted pages of the report only after suing CENTCOM under the Freedom of Information Act. The probe detailed how biases led analysts to make tragically wrong assumptions. For instance, they concluded that a package loaded into the car contained explosives because of its careful handling and size, and that the driver's erratic route meant he was trying to evade surveillance. Meanwhile, Truthout noted in this regard, U.S. military officials knew that an August 2021 drone strike in Kabul likely killed Afghan civilians, including children, but lied about it. A report published recently revealed New York Times investigative reporter Azmat Khan analyzed a 66-page redacted U.S. Central Command report on the August 29, 2021 drone strike that killed 10 members of the Ahmadi family, including 7 children outside their home in the Afghan capital. The strike took place during the chaotic final days of the U.S. ground war in Afghanistan just 3 days after a bombing that killed at least 182 people, including 13 American troops, at Kabul's international airport. Zamari Ahmadi, a 43-year-old aid worker for California-based nonprofit Nutrition and Education International, was carrying water containers that were mistaken for explosives when his Toyota Corolla was bombed by a Lockheed Martin Hellfire missile fired from a General Atomics MQ-9 Reaper drone. As reports of civilian casualties began circulating hours after the strike, U.S. military officials claimed there were no indications that non-combatants were harmed in the attack, while stating that they would investigate whether a secondary explosion may have killed or wounded people nearby. U.S. military officials initially claimed the righteous strike had prevented an imminent new attack on the airport. However, they later admitted that the botched bombing was a horrible mistake. The military's investigation was completed less than 2 weeks after the strike. However, it was never released to the public. The Pentagon said it would not punish anyone for killing the Ahmadi family. However, as the Times details, portions of a U.S. Central Command investigation obtained by the New York Times show that military analysts reported within minutes of the strike that civilians may have been killed and within 3 hours had assessed that at least 3 children were killed. The documents also provide detailed examples of how assumptions and biases led to the deadly blunder. Military analysts wrongly concluded, for example, that a package loaded into the car contained explosives because of its careful handling and size, and that the driver's erratic route was evidence that he was trying to evade surveillance. Furthermore, the investigation refers to an additional surveillance drone not under military control that was also tracking the vehicle but does not specify what it observed. The Times confirmed that the drone was operated by the CIA and observed children, possibly in the car, moments before impact, as CNN had reported. Hina Shamsi, an ACLU attorney representing families of the victims of the strike, told the Times that the investigation makes clear that U.S. military personnel saw what they wanted to see and not reality, which was an Afghan aid worker going about his daily life. When confirmation bias was so deadly in this case, you have to ask how many other people targeted by the U.S. military over the years were also unjustly killed, Shamsi added. Daphne Evitar, who heads Amnesty International's Security with Human Rights Program, called the new report more evidence than we need a huge change in how U.S. uses lethal force and assesses and reveals its consequences.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The Israeli regime has started the year 2023 on a bloody note.
Barely 2 weeks into the new year, Israeli forces have killed 9 Palestinians, 5 of them in a span of only 2 days since Wednesday. And among the victims are 3 Palestinian minors. Tel Aviv's land grab policy with demolition of Palestinian homes also continues unabated. In tonight's Spotlight program, we'll try to shed more light on the deteriorating condition that the Palestinians are facing. Our guests tonight are Mohsen Naghvi, human rights activist, joining us from Houston, Texas. And we also have attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmad Dmaya joining us from Johannesburg.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Naghvi in Houston. Tensions remain high across the West Bank, with the Israeli military stepping up its raids. So far this year, as we mentioned in our intro, 9 Palestinians have been killed. How do you view the recent wave of violence against Palestinians carried out by the Israeli regime?
Well, this is exactly what's expected off of this new regime. They have escalated the atrocities that they've been committed for years. This time around, they're using the pretext of wanted Palestinians, and that's how they're trying to justify their raids that they are doing, in which they recently killed Samir Oni Harbi, who was simply protecting his son from being arrested during these raids, and he was shot, brutally shot in the chest, and he was surrounded by Israeli soldiers and was brutally killed. This is exactly the policy of the new Israeli regime. Ben-Gavir is leading the new government, and this is what is expected of this new government. A 17-year-old girl was killed because she simply retaliated while her house was being demolished. Israel, we see a huge increase in settlement activities, which is in clear violation of the Oslo Accords. It's quite clear that this new government doesn't respect international law. It is clear that this new government wants to escalate the tensions that already exist between Palestinians and the Israelis. And it's quite clear that they want to occupy West Bank in its entirety.
Mr. Mayat, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned Israel's constant crimes, stressing that the martyrs' blood will not go in vain and the Israeli measures ultimately will only strengthen Palestinians' resolve to continue their resistance against the regime. Are these Israeli crimes, in your opinion, making Palestinians more united in the face of the occupation? And is that something that the Israelis are worried about, a united Palestinian resistance front, all groups and parties uniting against the occupation?
Most definitely. I think the greatest fear of the Israeli regime is the United Palestinian movement, and this has already manifested itself post Saif al-Quds. What is also becoming problematic is that there's a regional configuration that has taken place, where you see that there is support from movements such as Hezbollah in Lebanon. You see even support reaching far down as Yemen with Ansarullah, and as far to the east as Hashd al-Shabi from Iraq. The definite unity that has been presenting itself is in the form of lion's den. If you look at the Israeli assessments, they cannot pin particular individuals to specific organizations. What is very clear is that this is an amalgamation of numerous organizations. You see numerous of the shuhada, the martyrs, their bodies being covered in different flags from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which was formed by George Habash, which is a Marxist secularist movement, yet they have a religious connection. The latest martyr had a will where he says that he wants to die as a shaheed. This you see aligning with Hamas, and one of the other martyrs most recently was shrouded in a Hamas flag. So you see this principle of the unification of the fronts, and this is precisely what the Abbas regime under the Palestinian Authority fears, as they have become the enforcers of the Israeli state. What you do see is that there's an increasing support from the Palestinians, and this is not my own assessment, this is from Israeli sources, for the armed resistance movement. And this is what we are seeing now. We're seeing an escalation to an inevitable end, and that is a full-scale war where the red lines will have to be crossed by Israel, which is being crossed, and will inevitably lead to the dismantlement of the state.
Mossad Avi, there are a number of reprisal attacks against Israelis, some that even took place in the heart of Tel Aviv. Now, the occupied city of Jenin, for one, has recently been the focus of the Israeli aggression following a series of anti-Israeli operations there by Palestinians. Give us your perspective on the significance of these operations, as it seems Palestinians are venting their anger at the regime's crimes and occupation.
Sayyid Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, has gone on to praise these operations in one of his speeches. He talks about them in detail. What other options do you expect the Palestinians to have? They have tried every measure possible. International courts of justice have failed to provide any justice to Palestinians. The Israelis are constantly in violation of international law. They constantly commit these crimes, and the innocent stone-throwing Palestinian will eventually have to retaliate. And they're taking their inspiration from resistance forces like Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad. This is exactly how Hezbollah also started retaliating against the Israeli regime, and it worked. And it is clearly working now as well. I mean, Israel has been forced to push a government that is being run by a fascist called Ben-Gavir. We have never seen such issues within the Knesset before. Israeli ministers are asking the opposition to be arrested. Who was the next Israeli prime minister? Lapid. So we haven't seen these things before. It's quite clear that the Zionist regime is very vulnerable. It's never been this vulnerable before. And as the brother mentioned, we see forces such as the Lions then emerging now from the West Bank, who are fighting for their right, which is also within within the ambit of international law. They are simply defending themselves. And these activities that are being taken place by the Palestinians are in defense, not in offense. So it's praiseworthy, and this shows that they don't have many options but to fight back and retaliate with the limited means that they possess.
Mr. Mayed, Hamas reiterated that resistance against the occupying Israeli regime is a legitimate right. Hamas and Islamic Jihad have both said Israel is responsible for the repercussions of its aggression. Observers and analysts at this point are saying that we could be looking at the prelude for a third intifada. What's your take on that?
I think the third intifada has already begun. When you look at the escalations in various theaters, we look at Gaza, you look at what happened in the West Bank, what happens within Israel proper, you see an escalation across the board. And this is precisely what you referred to in the very beginning with regards to the unification, and exactly what my fellow panelist has just spoken about, the vulnerability of the state of Israel. Yes, it's an international law, right? It was exercised here in South Africa as well, with the armed movement of Umkhonto we Sizwe and many other factions when the late first president of South Africa, Nelson Mandela, stated that many believe that it is futile to continue to speak about nonviolence when the regime's answer is only savage attacks. This is precisely what we are seeing with Israel. Israel has gone so far as to elect one of the most right-wing governments that it's ever had, Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. These individuals are clearly off the cliff. They're not even on the spectrum. They have really indicated to everyone, including the U.S. administration, that they are prepared to take Israel to the brink of a war. This is what we are seeing now. We're seeing mass escalations across the board. And what we are actually seeing now is that Israel is cornered. If you look at the situation, Israel is trying to confine its activities to the West Bank with something that they refer to as security or operations, which is nothing more than an attempt to try and pacify their own population, whereas they are trying very hard not to escalate within Gaza as well as the northern front. Israel is weak. It is a glorified police state and has to resort to draconian measures to assert its deterrence, which has failed ever since 2006. It's a failed state. We are heading to a situation where Israel is talking about post-Abbas, post the Palestinian Authority, meaning that the enforcer is going to be lost on the ground. It only spells disaster for Israel. They need to be like the apartheid regime. Read the writing on the wall. It's over. There is no space for Zionism in the current world. There's no space for racism. There's no space for apartheid. It's time for this regime to read that writing, if they can read.
Mr. Narvi, on the issue of resistance, which you also spoke about a few minutes ago, an analyst that we spoke to here on Press TV believes that the Palestinians have every right to fight the Israeli occupation and that they should be supported in their struggle. Now, the question here is, do you believe Palestinians are receiving the support they need, and how can that support be enhanced?
Well, Israel receives $10.5 million a day in military aid by the U.S. government. In comparison to that, Palestinians don't receive anything. Even the Arab states have failed to support the Palestinians in any way whatsoever. May that be diplomatically or in terms of funding them militarily. The only power that we see that has supported the Palestinian resistance forces, and this is coming from Islamic Jihad and from the leadership of Hamas, is the Islamic Republic of Iran under the leadership of Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The one person who is single-handedly responsible for enhancing resistance activities against the Zionist regime was Sheikh Qasem Soleimani. And I believe it is this very reason that Ben-Gvir, in his failed attempt to create some kind of a symbol, stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the date of his Shahadat, which was January 3rd. So as the brother also mentioned, this is all, as we haven't mentioned, that Israel doesn't have more than 25 years. And Sayyid Nasrallah goes on to say that it may be less than 25 years that we see the end of the Zionist regime. Its very existence is unnatural in that region. It is only to an extent that oppression can sustain itself when you have people who are ready to give their lives for their freedom. I mean, they are arresting children. They are arresting kids under the ages of 12 under the military rule that they have in West Bank. 12-year-old kids, they are detained for an average of 2 years without any trial. So this kind of oppression has not been seen in history in the past. Yes, it is in comparison to the apartheid of South Africa, yes. But this is unprecedented. And the natural reaction to that is resistance, is defense. If you attack my home and you kill my kids and you rape my women, I will have to retaliate and defend myself. It is but natural.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. Mayor, let's talk about the actions of the new extremist Israeli cabinet at just a few weeks in. There was a visit by the fascist minister Itamar Ben-Gavir to the Nafa prison with the aim of harassing Palestinian prisoners there. Also, the office of the new Israeli prime minister announced financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority in their appeal, in response rather to their appeal at the ICJ. What are the Israelis trying to achieve with these actions? Hamas says that the extremist occupation government is planning a dangerous escalation.
I quote part of the question with regards to the activities of Itamar Ben-Gvir. Itamar Ben-Gvir has been an extremist. He is viewed so far off the political bill that even Israelis themselves consider him an extremist. Itamar Ben-Gvir's sole purpose is to declare a war against the Palestinians. He spoke about this even before he was elected into office. He said that he was looking to do a complete annexation of the Palestinian territories. These actions of incitement, of clear provocation, is to spark a war. There is a system that is currently running within Israel where they believe that the previous administrations had been too weak, had been too soft, and that they need to take the Palestinians head on. The problem is that the military advisors and administration of Israel does not concur with these political heads or these extremists in any manner or form. What they are advising is that any type of military confrontation now, particularly around the powder keg, the trigger, Masjid al-Aqsa, Bayt al-Maqdis, will spell the end of Israel. This is their own analysis, their own assessment. In fact, a key think tank within Israel, INSS, has just run a simulation simulating an eruption of violence around Haram al-Sharif. So what you are seeing is an attempt to try and push Israel to this point of no return. However, the calculation between the political movement as well as the calculation between the military aspects of Israel is vastly different. And I do believe, as I've said before, is that we are heading towards an inevitable end. Even if you look at the other aspect, the international law aspect, we are seeing repetitive victories by the Palestinians in pushing Israel towards accountability. You see the ICJ recently being asked by the United Nations by a vote in that favor to give an advisory opinion about the occupation and annexation. We see Israel's facing the possibility of a case of war crimes at the ICJ. These are good signs. However, I believe that with every international law step, it has to be coupled with military action, and this is what we're seeing on the ground. The Palestinians are resisting, and they are resisting fiercely, and this is bringing the Israeli regime to its knees, much like it did in South Africa. It was the armed resistance as well as other soft power systems.
Mohsen Avi, more land confiscations and evictions are being carried out by the Israelis, as pointed out numerous times. Under international law, the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population it occupies. Human Rights Watch has said Israel's policies amount to apartheid and crimes against humanity. Why are these policies continuing?
Well, as the brother also mentioned, these are all pressure tactics. How do you ensure that your power is through violence? When you are an entity like the Zionist regime, the only option that you have, the only way for you to stay in power is through oppression, is by exerting illegal power. And now, as the brother mentioned, that yes, international courts, international bodies are taking notice of these actions, but But to what extent? To what extent? Mere words will not bring about a change within the lives of the Palestinians, or they will not decrease the atrocities committed by the Israeli regime. The United Nations recently mentioned, and they said that punitive demolitions are a form of collective punishment. That's what the United Nations said, and they said that illegal, and they are illegal and under oppression law as to target the families of a perpetrator. So when more than one family is affected, Military Order 1797 by the Zionist entity is what conducts these demolitions. They justify the demolitions through that military order. But it is quite true that it is abused. It is illegal in the first place, and it is abused. It is constantly abused. The EU has taken notice of that. The United Nations has taken notice of this. But to what extent? What can we do with these notices until and unless they don't place sanctions on the Zionist regime? Nothing can happen, but we believe the least that the UN can do, the least that the international courts can do, is to place sanctions on the Zionist regime. But we believe in the one-state solution, which on the land of Palestine, Jews, Christians, Muslims, and anyone of any denomination can live respectfully and in peace. Whereas it is quite clear that the Zionist regime wants the exact opposite.
Mr. Mayet, in Johannesburg, on the same topic, what are the Israelis achieving with its land grab policy? Apart from Judaization of Palestinian land, are the Israelis also deliberately sabotaging any prospects of an independent Palestinian state in the future?
Definitely. The Israeli plan at the moment is to effectively evict the Palestinians and force them into the surrounding territories. There was a discussion recently on the Washington Institute where it was posed as a question that the Egyptians should take custodianship of Gaza, and this is a possible option that could be looked at to defuse the tension. This gives you an indication of the Israeli plan. Ehud Barak and Tzipi Livni had said at a previous conference, an IDC Heslia conference, that Israel is now facing a very clear choice, and this was approximately 4 to 5 years ago. They said that Israel is facing the choice of being a Jewish state or a Jewish democratic state, and if it chooses to be a Jewish state, it will become an apartheid state. What we are seeing is that this train is running headlong towards apartheid in the most open and most undiluted form. What you are seeing right now is that Israel is trying to create facts on the ground in the hope of swallowing the Palestinians. In fact, the Israeli High Court is quoted to have said that civilian Jewish presence is part of the regional security doctrine of the area for the West Bank. This shows you that even the justice enforcers, as we would like to look, look at the courts as, are just as corrupt and are enforcing the principles of apartheid. So yes, Israel is trying to create facts on the ground. What they are unaware of is that the fact is that you are heading towards a one state, and they do not have a demographic majority, nor do they have the military prowess to deal with the resistance that has been put up by the Palestinians. You can see how